still different considerations that are involved. And especially when you're comparing educational buildings to other types of buildings, you're really talking about a different comparison. And I really do think that the state is getting good quality buildings in the educational construction. I think they're buildings that may be cost a little more initially, but hopefully that initial construction cost will lower some of the life cycle costs, some of the operating costs that the state and school district is going to have to incur in the future. And the initial cost of a building is not the greatest cost of the building. The greatest cost of the building is the operation and maintenance costs over the lifetime. And the school districts are buying, the school districts and the state are buying buildings that are going to last for 20 to 50 years, as opposed to maybe a private developer who can amortize his costs over a shorter period of time, sell the building and get out. So I think it is a long-term investment that you have to look at. That's all I really have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Mr. Fitch, Senator Fisher.
If you estimate a building to be $20 million and the bid's committed $21 million, do you in fact have to go back and redesign that building at no cost to the architect if the school district decides, hey, we bond money for 20, the bid's committed $21 million?
Most of the cases, yes.
Is that a reason
it's
why?
Not,
well, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's not. It would have to be part of the contractual relationship between the architect and the owner, but that's a typical arrangement.
Okay, I guess my concern was I got a feeling a lot of bond issues are inflated. The estimates to protect. And I'm not saying you're going to be this way, but to protect the architect, so therefore their estimate's always higher than what the project's going to be. The other problem I have, not with you, but maybe the legislature's got to get a little bit more involved, is I have a hard time when a bond issue floated for 20 and the building cost 18.5 and there's now $1.5 million sitting on the table. The district in turn takes that money, can come down to the state and say, hey, we want to build a warehouse. We've already got our local effort in hand, and we need some cooperation on this, and I think that's the wrong way to do. I think that when there's leftover money from a bond issue, it goes back on the bond issue and may not be used unless the vote of the people comes about. And that's another problem I'd see addressed, that then that way there'd be no inflating of the bond issue to get a cash reserve out of it somehow, if they can use for interest. I would hope that the department can come up with some way of preventing that kind of abuse in the system.
Are there any other comments?
Just one, I guess, that I'd like to make. In terms of the inflated costs and inflated projections, it's really difficult for any cost estimator to look at a project today that he knows won't even be funded for almost a year, and the construction won't start from anywhere from 6 months to a year, and won't finish for another year. You're looking at a three-year cycle, or almost a three-year cycle, and trying to determine upfront what the costs are going to be when you don't have any real handle on what the inflation is going to be. And I think that is one factor that contributes to some of the high estimates in terms of initial cost estimate.
Well, I thank you all for coming today. I appreciate that. If there are no other comments to come before the committee, we'll meet tomorrow at 8:30. The earlier you're here, the sooner we will get started. And meeting adjourned. Thank you. The first bill up this morning will be House Bill 198. We're going in reverse order this morning because I've just been notified these folks have been in town waiting to hear this bill for a couple of days now. So just to make sure we get it done this morning, we'll make it first. That's about the only way to be positive you'll get your bill heard. So Senate Bill 198, or House Bill, excuse me, 198, is an act relating to municipal assistance for certain municipalities organized under federal law. Although the bill is made up of five different sections, there's really only one major change to the statutes. This bill adds Metlakatla, which is organized under federal law as an Indian reserve, as eligible for funds from the Municipal Assistance Fund. Metlakatla would be required to form a community development corporation, which would determine how these revenues would be spent. The corporation would have a board of directors, which would be elected by all of the eligible residents of the city of Metlakatla. Municipal assistance funds could only be given to the corporation if it had delivered a written waiver of sovereign immunity from legal action by the state to recover all or a portion of the money that is to be distributed. The community of Metlakatla has been working on legislation for a number of years. They had to jump through lots of different hoops because of the sovereignty problem and the reservation problem and the municipal code as it's written, and they have come down with this bill. And with that, I'd like to call Saul Atkinson from Metlakatla, who's a councilman there, to give us more information about the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning, sir.
Saul Atkinson, and I appreciate the chance to appear before this committee. And the council and the community appreciate you hearing this bill. I've served on the city council now for 11 years, having served one term as the mayor and city manager. and I'm well aware of all of the needs of the community. And we do have many needs, although we are a fairly small community, 1,300 people. We do have to provide all of the services that any other larger community must provide. So there's always a shortage of funds. We have a mayor, a 12-man council, a fire department, water, garbage, sewer. We provide all of the utilities, power and light. And there's always a deficit. So we appreciate the legislature considering municipal assistance for the Metlakatla Indian community. And I would be more than happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Senator Katua.
What other funding sources do you have to support the community, particularly those that maybe other communities don't have?
We have our own Annette Hemlock Mill. We own that, and we're presently leasing it out to the Louisiana Pacific Corporation for $131,000 per year. We charge for water and sewer, garbage. We have our own Annette Island Packing Company, a salmon processing plant, and we tax that to bring revenues into the city government. Then we have grants from the state, grants from the federal government for educational programs. We do have a state-operated school, and those sources are available.
Those are the only sources of funding that you have that you can depend on?
Yes, that's it.
Do you charge any taxes? Do you have any taxes besides the service charges for garbage and so on?
The council has recently gone on record to impose a 3% occupational tax. It has not taken effect yet to take care of the deficit that we now realize.
Senator Fisher?
Do you have any tax on property at all? There's no real property tax.
No real property tax, no sir.
Would the council consider, or are you considering any tax on real property?
Not at this point, Senator. At this point, we're trying to stay away from it, but as time goes on and the deficit grows, then it may have to be considered in the future. Yes. But at this point, no, the council is not considering it.
And I'm not sure what kind of revenue would be generated, but how about a sales tax? Have you ever thought about a sales tax?
That's what's happening.
We've thought about that. We've thought about all different methods of taxing, but it would be difficult on our senior citizens. We have quite a senior population. 70 and over themselves number in the 70s. And if we were to impose any of these taxes, it would put a definite hardship on the senior citizens. So they all own their own homes. They're able to live on what they receive from Social Security and the Alaska Longevity Bonus.
Again, I don't know what kind of value you have on real property, but the seniors would be covered under existing law. They wouldn't have to pay taxes on their home. So we're talking about those under 65 who own real estate, and I don't know how much you could generate. Well, you could generate enough tax to bring you out of the deficit, since you don't have any at this point. So that's just my concern, because the seniors would be protected.
It would be a consideration, yes.
Senator Kurtula, then Wagner, and
thank you. Can you legally bond for debt in your community? Go through a normal procedure of a vote for a particular project, program, school, etc. Can you legally bond for debt in your community?
Yes, we can.
Thank you.
Further questions? You notice the Department of Law's memo in your packets. Senator Eliason?
Madam Chair, let me apologize for the House member who submitted the bill. He has a conflict appointment this morning. However, I recall a testimony in Community Regional Affairs Agency committee 3 days ago. In effect, there are no monies coming into Metlakatla that other communities of the same type throughout Alaska receive. They're not receiving any additional monies from the federal government because they are a reservation.
Further comments? Discussion? Senator Kurtula?
I'd be willing to move the bill out if that's what you want.
It's been moved that we move the bill out with individual recommendations.
Individual recommendation.
Is there any objections to that? All right, so moved. Saul, thank you very much. Have a nice flight home.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, Senate Bill 51. This is an old friend. It's been with us every day this week. We have a new committee substitute before you. It's the work draft 5185. It's got across it, this bill will be heard this morning. Looks like this. Does everybody have a copy? I have extra copies if you don't. Senator Fertula?
Thank you, Chairperson. This has worked on intensively yesterday. Essentially, what this does is it covers the, and I do have the citation code here for AS 1407-0211, in case somebody wants it, for A and B. Essentially, this provides for a certain type of directive to school construction programs that are bonded, and it provides for 75 rather than 50% support. As you know, I think it was 2 years ago we had a 90% support. This is the area that I was speaking to, I wish to speak to on introduced legislation. The whole grant section is a different section. It's a different program. Frankly, this is the legislation that is vitally needed. If and when there become grants available, we may want to set a criteria for them. But there are very few now. And I would like to recommend, so far as I can see, this is a clean bill. And I'd like to recommend the Finance Committee adopt this legislation at this time. If it's less than perfect control of everything that's funded for school construction, so be it. What I'm recommending is the bonded portion, state participation, be increased. And I run several estimates in the next couple of years. My estimates are somewhat less than the DOE's, but perhaps they have enlightened knowledge that I don't have. I think it will cost us in interest contributions and capital contributions, the difference between probably $150 million of support and $225 million of support for the next couple of years for school construction, bonded indebtedness. You would extend it over 10 or 20 years, depending on the program.
Questions from the committee? Has everyone had a chance to look at it, Senator Sackett?
Just wanted to get the fiscal impact.
Fiscal impact. The note is correct, according to the department. Yeah. Steve, would you come forward, please? Steve Knoll from the Department of Education. $9 million. Bond issue floating around out there. We'd like you to go over the fiscal note again for the bill.
I'm Steve Wolf from the Department of Education. The bill would provide for reimbursement at a 75% rate for both existing and prospective indebtedness. The fiscal note dated 5185 with 75% in the upper right hand corner is still the appropriate fiscal note for this bill.
$970,000 for fiscal year 86.
Yes, sir.
How does that work, Steve? Why don't you go through the mechanics of how you develop that 970 is what we'd like to do.
5185. There are four separate issues, Madam Chairman, subject to the 50% reimbursement rate. Two for the city of Wrangell, one for Kenai, and one for the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. The total to be repaid for fiscal 86 is $3,008,000. The state's reimbursement at 50% would be $1,009,000. The 75% would be roughly $2.9 million. The difference is the $970,000.
So those are existing issues that are there, and this bill would automatically increase the payment to the municipalities.
Beginning in fiscal 86, that's correct.
Okay, so there's no impact on here on the bond issues that we know are pending, the Fairbanks bond issue, the Massey bond issue, and the Kenai bond issue.
There is certainly impact. It's not reflected in the fiscal note because it's indeterminate. I can't be exact. I can only give you a rough guess.
Okay, so let me get it so I get it in my head. This is absolute minimum of what we'll have to pay in 1986 because it's based on the existing issues that are out there now that are coming up for reimbursement next in fiscal year 86.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Sackett.
What is your rough estimate, based on the calls that you made this past week, the number of potential sales, et cetera, of further impact on FY 86?
The bill aside, I've been informed that the municipalities are looking at incurring in the neighborhood of $200 million in indebtedness for schools over the next 1, 2, or 3 years. Adding $100 million to that to represent the interest that will be paid, that's roughly $300 million, subject to whatever reimbursement provisions are in effect. Over a 10-year period, that's roughly $30 million a year. At the 50% reimbursement rate, that means $15 million. At 75%, that's roughly $22.5 million.
So the difference under the bill is a net of about $7.5 million.
Per year.
Per year.
Beginning in FY.
It depends on when they sell the bonds.
Yeah. Just based on tradition and past history.
If I had to guess, I'd say 4 or 5 of that fiscal 87 balance, at least by fiscal 88. Probably if the bonds are sold, if the bonds are authorized in their entirety, that is all $200 million contemplated by the municipalities, they'll be sold sometime in the spring. No payments will be made in 86. The first payments will fall due in 87. They will probably not sell all of the bonds authorized immediately. That's why I'm guessing there will be a phased impact.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Any further questions from the committee?
I would move this particular finance work draft as the finance committee substitute.
Ask unanimous consent.
I do, sir.
No objections. CS for Senate Bill 51 Finance. The work draft of 5185 is before you. Any more discussions on the bill?
I'd move it with individual recommendation.
The bill has been moved with individual recommendations. Any objections? So moved. Gosh, you guys are being awfully quiet. Good today. Senate Bill 82.
It's always fun.
I don't.
That's right, because next year.
I'm still in shock.
Senate Bill 82 is an act relating to weights and measures. In the original Weights and Measures Act, could the committee room be quiet, please? In the original Weights and Measures Act, the 1961 legislature established the Commissioner of Commerce was to serve as director of this division. However, the law is somewhat confusing. Therefore, these sections substitute commissioner whenever director appears. So they go through, and this is being classified as a technical language bill, they go through and delete, clarify language all the way through the various sections. The major change is the change from the word director to commissioner. Section 14 provides that the Department of Commerce, with power to issue citations for violations of load limits and overweight and oversized vehicles, is a policy change. I'd like to bring up Joe Swanson from the Division of Commerce and Economic Development to tell you anything else you need to know about this bill. Joe?
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Swanson. I'm the Director of Measurement Standards within the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. Madam Chair, you just want me to go through the bill or...
What questions of the committees have? What is the pleasure of the committee this morning on this bill?
Madam Chair, I move it out with individual recommendations.
It's been moved that we move out CS for Senate Bill 82 Transportation out with individual recommendations. Discussion? Any objections? The bill is so moved. Thank you, Mr. Swanson.
Thank you.
Very
good job.
Okay, Senate Bill 113, an act relating to state and municipal tax exemptions. You've got a sectional analysis in your packets. It was taken from the governor's transmittal note on the bill. It is a governor's bill. It's one they consider an important bill. The fiscal note is one that saves money. This extends senior citizen exemption from the state motor vehicle registration fee to the municipal registration tax. This section limits the exemption of vehicles used for personal rather than commercial use. Why don't we have Jeff Smith from the Department of Community and Regional Affairs come forward and talk about this bill. Jeff?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As the chair stated, this bill does a number of things regarding the senior citizen exemption programs. Regarding the motor vehicle section, when the law was originally passed, a loophole was created where the state has been put in a position to reimburse municipalities who suffer no loss of revenue. The language in this bill attempts to clarify that and clean that up so that no longer occurs. How that came about is There are some municipalities who exempt all of their citizens from paying any kind of motor vehicle registration or any kind of motor vehicle tax. And in those communities, the way the law is written, we're still required to reimburse the municipalities for the loss of revenue derived from that exemption by the senior citizens. This would make it for those communities that exempt everybody that the state will no longer reimburse them. The other items that the bill does is, one, provides us an administrative remedy, which we would only use as a last resort, but an administrative remedy that we feel that we need, especially in the light of declining revenues that we've experienced this year, and that's the ability for us to prorate the funds allocated for the different programs if the demand for the program exceeds the appropriation level. We ran into a problem for the first time 2 years ago in the homeowners program where we did not receive enough funding to meet the demand. We did not have the authority to prorate and had to come up with a very convoluted administrative procedure that was taxing on both the state staff and the municipality staff to come up with an equitable way to split the revenues between all of the municipalities of the state. So we are requesting in this bill prorating authority for all of the senior citizen reimbursement programs that we have with the municipalities. We have a commitment to fully fund these programs, and we have come in both fiscal year 84 and fiscal year 85 and requested supplementals to bring all the programs up to full funding. However, based on the current revenue declines and the projections for the fiscal year 87, we think that supplementals are going to be very difficult to fund next year. And without the ability to prorate, it's going to be difficult. The other major item that the bill accomplishes is under the homeowners program, it seeks to cap the value that we reimburse at $200,000. We've experienced tremendous growth in this program over the last few years, and we've run into competing state policies, as is sometimes the case, which is going to increase the cost dramatically in this program in the future. This is one way in which to deal with the spiraling cost of this program. However, the fiscal savings are not very dramatic or not very large. There are, I think, some other options that do need to be explored. I've talked informally with the Older Alaskans Commission and the Alaska Association of Retired People over the last year and a half regarding the problems with this program and the substantial increasing costs that we are experiencing. And I think that they are open, ready, and willing to sit down and have some kind of discussion on capping this program to hold down those costs. This is one idea to do that. However, there may be others, but this was our attempt to at least to begin something to cap the program, although the savings aren't substantial in terms of this year. In all of the senior citizen programs, we have $4,300,000 appropriated. I just had my staff do some projections on the demand for the fiscal year 86 programs. Right now, we're estimating demand at a little over $5,100,000. So, without even the fiscal year starting, we know that we're going to be about $900,000 short in the homeowners, renters, and disabled veteran programs. So I do think it's something that we need to deal with. This is one idea. However, there may be other options to explore that would save considerably more funds than this.
Commissioner, is this a common practice in states to exempt senior citizen property taxes or to rebate property taxes and motor vehicle taxes? Is that a fairly common practice out there in our sister states?
Yes, we've had done some research, and Minnesota probably has the most progressive program, even a little more progressive than Alaska's program, and there are, I believe, three other states, Massachusetts, New York, and the other one escapes me, that do provide some kind of reimbursement. But where their programs differ from ours is there is not unlimited value that those tax exemptions are provided for, and that's where we run into a serious problem. If the value of homes are up in the $400,000 and $500,000 range, to provide full 100% reimbursement, I think that we really need to examine that and come up with a way to limit that.
Senator Kutula.
Those states that have programs that might be, quote, more enlightened than ours, I think they all have income taxes, do they? Most of them have income taxes. Do they all have income taxes? State income taxes.
I didn't ask that information.
Do they have provisions for deductions for senior citizens from income tax?
I don't know that, Senator.
I'm going to guess that they do not. No significant, unless you're injured, ill, blind. So as a matter of fact, there is there is a significant greater tax on those senior citizens than there is in the state right at the moment. None of us pay income tax, personal income tax.
That's very true, Senator. I think the major policy question that we wanted to get out on the table for discussion and debate is this program similar in basis as the longevity bonus program, where we seek to reward the senior citizens for their past, present, and future contributions to the state? Or is this program really established to assist those senior citizens who have the most need in providing their property tax payments? And I think with the spiraling costs that we've seen in this program and the downturn in revenues, it's a policy question that I think begs to be answered and fairly soon.
Further question, Senator Halper?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is the definition that would apply to page 2? What is the definition of a motor vehicle that applies to this statute? It's probably in the statute. I didn't find it in the bill.
Bob,
do you have
that definition? I don't have the statute.
Doesn't include, is motor vehicle, including a boat, including airplanes, including large motorhomes, this kind of thing. What is a motor vehicle as far as the statute is concerned?
It's a vehicle that would be, it's a car or an automobile or a truck that would be used for personal use. We don't reimburse for any other forms of transportation other than a vehicle, a car. But the exact definition I don't have, and my staff doesn't.
Because in some cases, motor vehicle means substantially more than an automobile.
Is it your intent, Commissioner, to have just the vehicle, the family vehicle exempt, or was it your attempt also to exempt large motorhomes and airplanes?
No, as we've implemented the program in the past years, it's just been for the family vehicle.
Would the committee have any objections? You feel that we need to have a definition section added to the bill just to be sure?
I was just curious as to what it meant.
Senator Fisher?
Madam Chair, if you just made it, what is it for an automobile? I'm not even sure. What is the tax, $25?
The average reimbursement under the program is $18.60.
No, I was going to say maybe you could put a dollar amount in, then that way you wouldn't have to define it.
Does anyone on the committee feel it's necessary to put a definition section in here? It seems to me the department is handling it. They're trying to cut back. I don't think they're going to add motorhomes and airplanes, but does anyone feel that we need to nail it down?
Well, I think, Chairperson,
yes,
at least for the record of the Finance Committee, it ought to be stated that during these discussions that we intended to not provide exemptions for the specific items that you mentioned, Senator Halper mentioned, and others.
Airplanes, boats, motorhomes.
Okay, so we will not be giving exemptions to airplanes, boats, and motorhomes. Okay?
And items of that type of luxury, there's got to be other things, too, that in that category. Sports luxury.
Senator Fisher?
No, I don't. No, that's fine. I was just thinking of some people that own pickups and things like that are included in the family vehicle.
Yes, we'd reimburse for a pickup. Madam Chair, there are two pieces of legislation working through the legislature now that have incorporated some aspects that are in Senate Bill 113, and those are Senate Bill 84 has incorporated the motor vehicle language to close that loophole. Senate Bill 190 has been amended to include both the prorating language and the spousal exemption, which is included in 113.
Any more discussion about Senate Bill 113? Senator Ferguson?
Yeah, is the $200,000 high enough for somebody who's been surrounded by a town and lived there for the last 30 years?
Commissioner?
Well, one of the concerns we had in putting a dollar amount on there was that somebody may have homesteaded and now has a piece of property in a very valuable location of their community and may not have the resources to pay for it. We have provided that the $200,000 cap can be waived for those circumstances.
Will it be?
Yes. We are not interested in implementing this to hurt any senior citizen that can't afford it.
You're not trying to harass the old timers?
No.
That's what I was accused of last year, and I tried the same thing. Senator Cotullo.
Such an inexact art, making that type of decision and applying for it. And fortunately, and perhaps fortunately, but people can sit on a piece of property and live in a shack like I do. They can live in substandard housing, but for no reasons of any service, no better roads, no improvements, perhaps not even REA facilities, because of subdivisions and other things that have been through state subsidy programs and so on, have come moved around them. Their taxes goes up and go up, and they go up a lot more than $200,000 on these 40 acres of ground and so on. And Senator Helford wishes to join me in my statement, I think, one part of it. But the facts are that their ability to earn, why are we tinkering with that? You know, it's very, very difficult for me to accommodate these continuing spiraling increases for true old-timers. People I'm talking about are in their late 70s and 80s. And $200,000 isn't going to handle it for them. And still, they're living in substandard housing. It's just their farms and their homesteads and so on. And they have paid for 40 years in our area for support for school and so on, long before there was statehood. That bothers me, that $200,000 maximum for existing, at least, people that made such a contribution. May I offer the ball? I'm reading
to them. Senator Halford.
Madam Chair, I wonder if we could offer a letter of intent which made it clear that we did intend that those exemptions be granted to those who are living in the same place that they've lived for the past 10 or 15 years, or however many years, that those exemptions really are the intent of the legislature.
Senator Halford, I assign you the job of writing a letter of intent to be on the floor to accompany this bill if it gets there for a vote. Senator Ferguson.
I said I wondered if.
You get the job.
Madam Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 113 out with the letter of intent with individual recommendations.
It's been moved. Any objections? So moved. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
And Senator Halford, we're all eagerly awaiting your letter of intent. Representative Copeland has been waiting to testify in front of the committee for House Bill 335, so let's go on to House Bill 335 at this time. Thank you, Senator Ferguson. I didn't know if you two were going to have the violins coming out or what was going to happen at any moment.
But the problem is, and there really is a problem, we have excesses, and there's no doubt.
Morning.
Senator Ferguson, you saved us from the violins and the violence over here.
Yes.
I know, but he sits where he doesn't have to worry about it with these people.
Yep.
Yeah. If I knew anybody that had $200,000 piece of property,
making his midwifery,
I'd tell him to sell some of
it. Come on, bring it. Exactly. No,
okay, we have before us House Bill 335. This is an act relating to the practice of midwifery. Is that how
we were also suggesting midwifery, but
whatever. Representative Copeland, would you tell us about this bill, please, sir?
Well, thank you. To identify myself, I'm Representative Nilo Copeland from District 21. Co-chair of House Hess. This bill has been amended on the Senate side, and I think the solution is one that recognizes the political reality that the administration will not approve a new board, but it does meet the principal goals of the pieces of legislation, the several pieces of legislation that have been moving through, put them all together. It keeps midwives legal. And allows lay midwives. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you're quite correct, Senator Fakes. Nurse midwives do practice currently. They are not found in all areas of the state, and in some areas of the state, because of the relationship to the medical board, they will not supervise home births, which seems to be a principal problem in among our constituents. And also, this bill also has provision for sufficient regulation to protect the public. It doesn't cost very much money. In fact, this bill is under $10,000, the fiscal note. And in fact, I think that may even be somewhat inflated. Without a board, of course, it doesn't have provisions whereby the public, the medical profession, and the lay midwives can participate in developing the training programs or the but I'm sure that the Department of Health and Social Services will keep alert to that, and changes in the regulations will be reasonable.
Representative, what's the difference between a lay midwife and a midwife?
Midwife is a generic term. There are lay midwives and nurse midwives. In the state of New Mexico, the Board of Lay Midwifery had become just the Board of Midwifery, for example. Nurse midwives are registered nurses who have taken an additional year of training to become midwives in addition and practice on their own. They're somewhat, you might say, they're sort of nurse practitioners in a limited area of practice, whereas a lay midwife has only taken the course in midwifery and in some states has undertaken an apprenticeship assisting an existing practitioner.
So a lay midwife is not a nurse?
A lay midwife is not a nurse, has not taken the course in nursing.
Senator Catula?
They may have.
What about the naturopaths and so on? Lot of them practice midwife work, I understand.
Well,
are they considered lay midwives under this program?
They would not, unless they chose to show the department that they had taken the kind of training program that and met the regulation requirements. I presume under this, for example, a nurse midwife could also register under this if they wanted to. There would be a number of classes of people who, if they met the regulations, could practice. They could have this shingle in addition, but I'm not in, and they wouldn't, by fact of being a naturopath, automatically be allowed to practice.
My question, Representative Copeland, really was, there is no category for, say, that group of people now to do this practice. So they would be lay midwives if, in fact, they met those qualifications.
Right.
They don't come under any other program for practicing. I think that's true.
For example, someone here may have a pilot's license, but they're not a pilot by dint of being a member of the legislature. They've also met those other requirements.
Yeah.
I don't know, we pilot here and pilot there.
Senator Ferguson?
What's the difference between someone that charges for service and someone that doesn't?
Well, this license is a profession or a trade, and therefore it covers them. Someone who happens to attend a birth, woman's husband, for example, or taxi cab driver, as happens once in a while, is not automatically thereby a midwife.
Senator Perrin.
Yes, thanks. Yes, Senator Petula.
I was looking at Senator Perrin just a second ago in my mind. Yes, Senator Fakes, I apologize. That threw me for a second, too. But medical malpractice and that type of legislation, is there anything that you've run into while developing this legislation that would suggest that there will be substantial insurance programs that these people have to come under or will come under? They'll have the same medical liability, surely, that any practitioner would have that was in gynecology and so on, obstetrics and so on.
They would have one requirement, I should think, that they should have to enforce it to make certain that the family contacts the physician, brings the child in for examination and the like, and of course doesn't hesitate to call in a physician if it does turn out that the case is a high-risk one. By the statute here, they are prohibited from taking people who are considered high-risk, and there are a number of classes of people whom they themselves consider high-risk. Physicians may consider.
Is there a class of insurance available for them? I'm sure there's Lloyd's, but is there any other states that you've examined?
The other states, there is insurance available for them. Policies have been developed. I'm not entirely sure, in view of the problems insurance companies are having in other areas, whether, you know, what the rates are going to be. There's no information available on that.
Further discussion? Senator Halper, I'm sorry.
This includes the practice of midwifery for a fee.
Right. or donation.
Does that practice include any surgical procedure?
It should not.
Does the legislation address the question of stitches or physiotomy?
Not specifically.
Could you repeat the question, Senator Halper?
Does the legislation address the question of stitches or physiotomy? Or?
Senator Farrington, why don't you come to the table? You are more than welcome to come to the table.
The problem is, I think, sometimes done as a as an emergency procedure by midwives. I know that some physicians do it.
Physicians often do it as a matter of course.
As a matter of course. In a natural birth, it shouldn't be necessary, but it is possible.
But they do if they have to. Senator Lyson?
Have you received any POMs on this issue?
A few.
Received any POMs?
On all sides. Yes, I should say that we've received some, we've got a great many from consumers, a great many from lay midwives themselves. The nurse midwives as a group oppose it, although we have gotten individual POMs from nurse midwives approving it. And we've received POMs from physicians in support and opposing it. Everyone seems to have one opinion or
an interest, about, right?
Further questions?
Madam Chair, I might bring to your attention that that many of the things put in here are temporary regs until they work out the room and will be automatically repealed at the time they come up and approve the regs with the physician and the group.
Senator Farrington.
Yes, Senator Petula.
Thank you. I was looking at her again.
I have that effect on people.
I see. Well, I'm glad you do. He obviously doesn't pay any attention to
me. I meant to directly ask her the question, and I realized my error this time.
No, see, the myth about being co-chairman of finance is just that. It's just a myth.
Please excuse me.
Senator Petula, your question. Senator Farrington, did Senator Halford's question get answered about tearing necessary surgery 50 miles from an MD? We have pretty good phone systems, even if they've been contacted and available. I could imagine them greater differences. We certainly are going to have to be allowed certain emergency services if it's just a Good Samaritan situation, you know, in birthing. And I just was curious about Senator Halford. I thought that was
I think Bonnie Lang's here and could answer some of that. I think it'd be unusual, but in cases where it's